Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the tax deal President Obama made with the Republicans means very bad news for black people. A federal court ruling against President Obama's health care bill may be good news for single-payer advocates in the long run. And civil liberties forces ponder how to stop the American government from targeting U.S. citizens for assassination.
But first, last week, 131 people allowed themselves to be arrested at the White House in protest of U.S. wars and the government's campaign to silence WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The protest was organized by Veterans for Peace, but included a wide range of social activists, including Dr. Margaret Flowers of Physicians for a National Health Program. She says the times require confrontation with the Obama administration.
We need to realize that the regular tools that we're using to affect change are not working, and that if we really want to see the change that we need in terms of all areas, not just peace. For me, I was standing there to show that this is a show solidarity and that this is a broader problem that we have with things like healthcare, jobs, and education, and that we need to resist and disrupt if we want to start shifting the power in our direction.
What do you mean the regular tools that are not working?
Well, it seems at this point that our political process is so broken that, you know, what we've done before, which is, you know, having pieces of legislation and then educating people about them, organizing them to, call into their member of Congress and try to get legislation passed, those things don't work. Well, they may still be important. They're not sufficient. And so right now the control is just so heavily in the hands of corporate power. We can't do anything about that unless we start to disrupt things in a way that makes them take us seriously.
It's also very difficult to get constituencies that are usually put under the Democratic umbrella to move with a black Democratic president in power, isn't it?
That's been a huge problem. If the same things had been happening under a different president, I think that the response would have been very different in this country.
And you were talking about broader coalitions of folk.
Exactly. I think that there are so many different groups working on separate issues, but all these issues are boiled down to one thing, that it's corporate power that's influencing the process and causing us not to get what we require in this country. So I believe that all of the movements working for peace and social and economic justice need to come together to challenge that corporate power and move the agenda back in the direction of justice. I think that more and more people are coming to the realization that that our country is really off track, that the job problem, the housing problem, the economic problem, healthcare continues. These problems continue to deteriorate, and what we see is Congress and the administration coming up with really the wrong solutions, and more people are realizing that and getting upset about it. And that's going to lead to discontent in this country. And I think it's important that we organize in ways that people can channel that energy and that discontent into constructive, nonviolent actions. And that's why I think it's really important that we need to put in place broad coalitions that are working together to affect the change that we need.
That was Dr. Margaret Flowers of Physicians for a National Health Program.
Prior to last week's protest, upstate New York political activist John Halley circulated a letter challenging what he called the left establishment to endorse the demonstration at the White House. Halley said well-known figures on the left, like Bill Fletcher and Tom Hayden, have failed to confront the Obama administration's policies of aggressive war.
No, I don't think any of us should feel satisfied with the level of support. It should have been a much more high-profile event, as far as I can tell. It was largely buried by the mainstream media, and they were able to ignore it because simply the numbers weren't sufficient for it to draw attention to itself, and the range of support was not really all that broad. It was mostly limited to the so-called peace community centered around the Veterans for Peace, that are a superb organization, but they've been doing these things for a long time, and maybe it's a somewhat expanded core that was involved in the demonstration. But if the unified left had backed this demonstration and supported it, the numbers would have been by a factor of 100 larger, and it would have been far more disruptive and far more apt to get the attention of the folks who should be giving it attention.
You issued a challenge to what you called the left establishment to support this action, to show that they had actually broken with Obama. Specifically, you were challenging two founders of Progressives for Obama, Bill Fletcher and Tom Hayden, to show their stripes. Did they show their stripes?
Well, both of them responded, and I then made a response to both of them, and I thought their responses were very revealing. Hayden lukewarmly supported the demonstration, though he said it was probably not a good idea, even though it was, quote, somewhat justified. Fletcher, in his response, failed even to mention that we were asking him to support the demonstration at all. It was as if, you know, he simply didn't even read what we were asking him to do, which was to strongly support this demonstration. Hayden, lukewarm, you know, even cold response is indicative of exactly what the problem is. They have not broken with Obama. They're still supporters of Obama, albeit of the quote-unquote critical variety, but critical support is no longer sufficient, or it's no longer even acceptable. It needs to be develop into active opposition to the Obama administration's policies.
I don't understand what critical support means. They've used those terms over and over again, and I still don't fathom the meaning.
Nor do I, increasingly. It means that you can oppose the Obama administration on certain specific issues, or maybe even a range of issues, right? So that means you can oppose the administration's position on Afghanistan and Iraq. You can oppose the administration's position of EFCA. You can oppose the administration's position on climate change. You can oppose the administration's position on human rights and civil rights. But at the end of the day, you're not going to support active protest in the form that we saw yesterday, and hopefully other instances to come, of these specific policies, ones that call direct attention to the failure of the administration to act on what it had promised to do, or when it actually engages in objectively reactionary politics.
This is kind of ironic. Both of these individuals and others were predicting during Obama's candidacy that his candidacy would somehow engender a broad-based movement, and yet they don't join with whatever movement actually exists.
Right, and in fact, that should have been predictable, first of all, that there would not be a broad-based movement, or if there were a broad-based movement, the Obama administration would be in opposition to it. It's predictable, of course, when a Democratic administration enters the White House, that certain aspects of the protest movement are going to be undermined, because those that were previously on the outside protesting the previous Republican administration are invited into generally low to mid-level positions in the White House, and they're invited there specifically for the purpose of convincing those who are on the outside that they have friends now and that they don't need to actually protest on the outside. They have friends that will do their work for them on the inside. And Hayden and Fletcher and similar sorts of folks on the left are particularly susceptible to those sorts of blandishments and the appeals of what they regard as access to the administration. In fact, they have no such access. But the perception on, or the delusion on their part that they have this access is sufficient for them not to join with others and to join in a unified movement calling for direct opposition to the administration's policies.
At the end of your letter, you seem to be indicating that if these gentlemen ever come around to adapting a more actively oppositional stance, that you'd be willing to welcome them with open arms. I just wonder, how long should that invitation be open?
No, oh, good heavens, I really don't know. As you read my words back to me, detect a slightly, maybe appropriately critical tone in your voice, Mr. Ford. And in fact, maybe I should engage in my own self-criticism in owning up to the fact that when I was writing those words, I had some doubts as to whether they should in fact be welcomed back with open arms. But if they are welcomed back, they need to be welcomed back, I think, with a considerable amount of suspicion given their past behavior. I guess the only thing I would like to add is that there's been a pretty active campaign among some elements of those who were targeted by the letter, either to ignore it, but also to stuff it down the memory hole, to pretend that it doesn't exist. So all of the follow-up pieces that we've tried to write in support of the original letter and to circulate it more broadly have been ignored by the mainstream outlets, including those which ran the initial letter. So we're currently engaged in pretty much door-to-door grassroots politicking so that the letter continues to circulate. And I will give its website, www.protestobama.com. One word, .org, www.protestobama. We now have about 4,600 signatures, and our goal is 5,000. However, the traffic, to be honest, has dropped precipitously over the last few days as it has dropped off the radar screen of those few outlets that have covered it. And also, the Haydens and the Fletchers of the world have been making an active attempt to undermine, quite dishonestly, I should say, some of the premises on which the letter is based.
What do you mean, dishonestly?
I'll be quite specific about that. Michael Albert of ZNet has claimed that the letter was based on false pretenses. Specifically, he has claimed directly that we intentionally misled those we were initially soliciting for support, that the letter was not directed to the recipients, but was in fact deriving from the recipients. So in fact, Hayden and Fletcher and the others were in fact endorsing our goals, and we were calling on those we were soliciting to join in with us. Albert claims that we deliberately misled him into thinking that we were not criticizing those people, that we were joining with him. As anyone who knows that was in on the drafting of the letter, the intent was always to criticize the Haydens and the Fletchers and the Moores and the Aaron Reichs and the Dysons. We never let them off the hook, and we were joining with we were attempting to unify with the rest of the left a call to push them to do what was necessary.
That's amazing. I saw the first draft of the letter, and it was immediately clear to me and to everyone at Black Agenda Report that this letter was a challenge to them.
Right. They don't like to be challenged. That's one thing that has been clear from the from this process, is those that are in positions of authority, even minimal positions of authority, including those who claim that they are anti-authoritarian, don't like to have their authority challenged.
For the record, Nellie Bailey, myself, and other members of the Black Agenda Report team were signatories to John Halley's letter.
The tax bill put together by President Obama and the Republicans, pass both houses of Congress, despite strenuous objections by about half of the Democrats in the House. We spoke with John Berg, author of the book Unequal Struggle, Class, Gender, Race, and Power in the U.S. Congress. We asked Berg if Obama's deal with the Republicans caught him by surprise.
Oh, yeah, I was astounded, actually, and kind of appalled, and more so as I found out the content of the deal. Originally, I was astounded because I thought it was far too early to be doing that, but it was a chance to get more than he did. But as I heard more about it, I think the two features of the package are especially bad and really outweigh any good things in it. And the one that we're all hearing a lot about is the tax cuts for the super rich. And I think it's more than a matter of fairness. It's a matter of we've reached so much inequality in wealth and income in this country today that it turns into political power. It turns into a situation where all the limits on the use of money in politics have come off. And as the super rich and the people, the investment bankers who own big corporations get more and more money, they're using it to buy elections, to buy candidates, not even to buy elections for themselves. And it's hard to reverse once it happens because they have more power and they make more laws more favorable to themselves. And then we have to sort of work in the context of those laws to try to even things up a little bit. It's very good. So I thought that was atrocious. And that's both the inheritance tax and the, you know, the income tax cuts. The other part of it, which I really think is very bad, and we have not been hearing very much about, is that the undermining of Social Security in the guise of a payroll tax holiday. And that just makes no sense to me at all, because for years we've been hearing that Social Security is in trouble because we're going to reach a point in a few decades where the revenues coming into the Social Security trust fund aren't going to be enough to pay out the benefits. And that may or may not be exaggerated, but certainly if it is true at all, then it makes no sense to reduce the revenues going into it. I mean, that's just going to set up a crisis in Social Security that will come much sooner and really be hard to resolve because it's without the revenue, you can't pay the benefits. And I think that's you know, going to endanger a lot of people who are counting on that bit of money when they retire. At some point, people just have to say, yeah, we've had enough. I mean, right today in Greece, there's another general strike because people are saying, well.
Your book is titled Unequal Struggle, Class, Gender, Race, and Power in the U.S. Congress. You've talked about class. Let's talk about race.
And I'll give you a good example. A tremendous, huge example is the economic crisis and the crash that led to the crisis. Now, what really caused that crash was irresponsible behavior by investment bankers and more than irresponsible, fraudulent, putting together these phony derivatives that weren't based on anything. The way it's being portrayed in sort of conservative circles is that it was all caused by poor black people who didn't deserve mortgages being given them because the government required them to, which is just total nonsense. It wasn't what happened. It was people being defrauded, you know, and it wasn't that the government required anyone to do that. It was that profiteering bankers were out there and luring people into getting mortgages that they couldn't pay because then they could make money off of that.
Dr. Maya Rockymore runs a Washington-based public policy outfit called Global Policy Solutions. She authored an article that appeared in Black Agenda Report, warning that the Obama administration's deal with the Republicans will have negative impacts on future generations of black and brown Americans. Was Dr. Rockymore surprised that Obama came to an accommodation with the GOP?
Let's put it this way. I was surprised that they waved their white flag on extending the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest so early in the game. I think it was literally a couple of days, if not one day, after the midterm elections that David Axelrod gave a comment to the New York Times letting them know that they're willing to extend the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest. So they hadn't even stepped into the arena of negotiations before they waved their white flag. which is quite disturbing.
You take a long view look at this legislation, and in light of the demographic trends that are quite evident in American society.
Many people forget that, you know, our demographics are changing. Our nation is becoming majority-minority. What I mean by that is the Latino immigration boom has caused the racial and ethnic composition of our society to change dramatically. And the Census Bureau projects by the year 2042, the nation will be predominantly black and brown. By the year 2070, we're looking at our nation's seniors being predominantly black and brown. So when we're having today's conversations about tax cuts for the wealthy that are not paid for, they're not offset, they are pushed into the future for others to pay for, the others that they're talking about paying for it are our children, are the black and brown children of this today who will be tomorrow's adults and older adults. So, you know, I think many people think that this money is free. And while it may look free because they're printing it right now, the reality is that the bill will come due at some point. And the bill will come due just as our children reach maturity.
And what kind of bill will that be?
It will be a huge bill. Let's see, we're talking about two unfunded wars, an unfunded new Medicare benefit. We had certainly a stimulus that was needed but unfunded. We'll still probably have some dollars that were not paid back to TARP that were unfunded. Certainly, we're looking at tax cuts for the wealthy, Bush tax cuts for the wealthy that were unfunded. So we're talking about a huge, massive bill. Now, what many people are not paying attention to is that the Obama administration, in collaboration with primarily conservative Democrats and Republicans, is that they've already put together the plan in terms of how to address that huge debt and deficits. And that was through the authorization of this Obama appointed a deficit commission to come up with a plan to make the cuts that would be needed. And it shouldn't be a surprise that those cuts are to the very programs that are important for our communities. Cuts to Social Security, to Medicare, to Medicaid, you know, the programs that we disproportionately rely on will see dramatic reforms that are likely to reduce the level of benefits, if not eliminate some.
If we look into the future, as you have done, we see income disparities, which are already dramatic, combining with racial disparities that are already historically dramatic to create a kind of new monster, aren't we?
Yeah, well, as of today, we know that there are huge racial wealth disparities in our country. 2007 Federal Reserve data shows that for every $1 in wealth that white Americans have, Latino Americans have 12 cents, and African Americans have only 10 cents. Now, that data was collected before the recession. So we can expect that when the next set of data comes out, that we'll see even starker wealth disparities by race and ethnicity. And so we know that communities of color have been hardest hit by the recession. If you just look at the unemployment figures, look at who's getting foreclosed upon disproportionately. So then you have to wonder if this is the state of our if this is the state that our communities are in today, what will it look like 10 years out? In fact, what will it look like for our children? They are the children of the recession generation. They will be building up, literally climbing out of a deep hole. And as they're climbing, trying to climb out of this deep hole, they'll be assessed with another huge burden, and that is the cost of paying for all of these poorly designed policies that we see coming out of Washington now. Case in point is the tax cut for the wealthy.
We're seeing cities and states in fiscal crisis, yet the mantra seems to be starve the beast, starve not just the federal government, but the state governments and local governments.
It's amazing, isn't it? We do know that our states and localities, we know that some of them are actually literally going bankrupt. We know that bonding rating agencies are actually downgrading some of the some of these municipalities and states because they can't pay their debt and they have to restructure their debt. But at the same time that we're seeing this struggle, and by the way, that means that police services are being cut, firefighter services are being cut, education is being cut. All of the things that we have come to know and expect that our government provides, these things are on the chopping block, okay? So just leave that, park that. And then realize that the federal government has been the only resource as a stopgap measure for many of these states through the stimulus funds. And that's because the federal government has been printing money that they've been borrowing from other countries, namely China, printing money in order to help bail out the states. Now, at some point, the federal government is going to have to stop that spigot. They cannot continue this forever. There will be a price to pay. There is no free lunch. And so you've got to understand that when they talk about tax cuts for the wealthy, it's not in a vacuum. There are actually consequences that when you're making that policy decision, you are affirmatively making the decision not to help fund struggling states or localities. You're making the affirmative decision not to invest in other things like education. You are making the affirmative decision to basically give very vital, critical, and scarce resources to a portion of the population that absolutely does not need it. And I would argue at the expense of everything we know and love about this country, certainly at the expense of state and local government, and certainly at the expense of our children.
And what is often not mentioned is that blacks are disproportionately represented in government employment at the federal, state, and the local level.
Well, I think that certainly at the federal government level, there's already been an immediate impact when the president froze the pay of federal government workers. At the state and local level, absolutely, you are seeing the employment of teachers being cut. You know, I mean, if you just look at it across the board, all of the jobs that we saw as pathways to the middle class, these jobs are actually in jeopardy because of the fiscal crisis being experienced by local and state governments, and ultimately by our federal government if we can't get this thing in check.
We saw black communities devastated by the subprime mortgage crisis and then devastated again by the unemployment mortgage crisis, and yet government is being starved of funds. Where does this take us?
Well, this is interesting, right? We've got money to provide tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, and by the way, that the proposed bill also has sweeteners for corporations too. And yet, you know, some of these programs that have been put in place to help homeowners, they're saying that they don't have enough funds to make some of these homeowners whole. Certainly, we know that some of the federal programs are not operating at optimal levels. In fact, they are operating at suboptimal levels. Only a few people actually getting through and actually getting assistance. And so we know that there's only been a half-hearted effort at really helping struggling homeowners. And then you have to, when you juxtapose that very fact with this decision to provide supports for people who don't need it, you have to wonder about the priorities.
The president's Deficit Reduction Commission wants to raise, eventually, the retirement age under Social Security to 69.
Many people don't know that President Obama appointed a bipartisan, and I say bipartisan in quotes, Deficit Reduction Commission earlier in 2010. I think it was January or February. And he did this in response to a revolt in the Senate by conservative Democrats and Republicans who tried to get the measure enacted into law for a congressionally mandated commission. And when that measure failed, then President Obama stepped up to the plate and actually appointed this commission. And I say bipartisan in quotes because it was the appointees to this commission were primarily those who are known. To want to cut Social Security or to privatize Social Security. The majority of individuals appointed to that commission were people who are hostile to social insurance programs in this country, which means that you're hostile to the agenda of working and middle-class people. So, you know, the findings after months-long deliberations, not surprisingly, the commission actually came out with a report where they seek to do a number of things, only one of which is actually enacting Social Security benefit cuts in the form of raising the retirement age. Many people don't realize that raising the retirement age is a benefit cut, but it is. because you have to work longer. That means you get less benefits over time. And those people, because of retirement age is raised, there are more people who die before they ever get to retirement age. So the program saves money in that way. But that particular policy actually represents a significant cost shift. In fact, it's a transfer of Social Security wealth away from people of color, particularly African Americans and Native Americans and others with lower life expectancies, to wealthier Americans, whiter Americans, those who have longer life expectancies. And so we need to understand that when they're talking about raising retirement ages, that it actually has racial and ethnic implications because of the health disparities that we have in this country, as well as the classism that we have, that more blue-collar workers are working in labor-intensive jobs that take them out of this world earlier rather than later. And really, you've got to realize, all of these people have paid into Social Security all their working years, and they raise the bar in a way that is discriminatory, certainly on a racial and ethnic basis and a class basis.
And yet, this administration in this bill endorses cutting a holiday of a kind on payments into Social Security by lowering the rate of payments, undermining the funding of Social Security down the road.
So isn't this curious, right, that Social Security, a program that has been self-sufficient and self-sustaining, it never has taken a transfusion of general revenue. It's funded by payroll taxes that workers contribute. Now, the federal government, the larger federal government, has always borrowed from the Social Security trust funds, but Social Security has never had to borrow from the federal government. And so we know that a lot of people are out there saying, well, Social Security needs to be fixed. Social Security needs to be fixed because in the year 2037, it's going to have a shortfall of 25 cents on every dollar. Now, some people say it's going bankrupt. It's not going bankrupt. It will have a shortfall. And so we know that this shortfall, if nothing is done, that shortfall will be there. So it's curious that the administration is actually proposing a payroll tax holiday that would reduce the amount of the payroll taxes that people pay into it for the next 2 years, and ultimately cause the fiscal crisis, if you will, associated with Social Security to actually be intensified. When you take away a significant chunk of a designated revenue source for Social Security, because the payroll tax funds Social Security, that means that you're putting its finances in further jeopardy. Now, that's counterintuitive, right? So then you've got to wonder what else is going on. Why are they seeking to undermine or destabilize the Social Security program? Now, they would argue that this is an immediate stimulus. People get their money back in their pockets. They can spend it. And that is true for the short term. But, you know, what's that saying about cutting off your nose to spite your face? Our faith is that Social Security program. We want to make sure that by the time when we need that program, that it's fully funded, that it has the resources that it needs to pay out the benefits that we need in our communities, particularly our vulnerable seniors, our people who are disabled, and certainly our survivors, children and other dependents who are in need of resources that Social Security provides. So I think that we need to be very alarmed that they're talking about a payroll tax holiday. It is not a holiday. It may actually be a prison sentence for Social Security if we're not careful.
I remember 6 years ago when the Republicans were launching an attack on Social Security. The line that they used in trying to get black folks to go along with it was that Social Security was discriminatory against blacks because blacks didn't live as long as white folks. And yet now they want to raise the retirement age to just about the time that the average black man dies.
Well, you know, it's interesting. So, you know, so it was Obama's deficit commission, not Obama himself, who has endorsed this plan. But he did appoint the commission, or a number of the commission members. But you also have people like, well, actually one person, Harold Ford Jr., who's out there on a regular basis, saying that we need to raise the retirement age. And, you know, Harold has even gone so far to say that he will forfeit his retirement benefits. Which is great for him, but I hope that he realizes that he is selling out his fellow African-American men when he says that, because the life expectancy, at birth life expectancy for African-American men, I don't think it's 70 yet. I think it's actually between 68 and 69. And yet when they propose to raise the retirement age to 70, you know, you're really talking about, you know, really disadvantaging those very men who have worked all their lives and are most likely to die before they can get their benefits. So, yes, that is a problem, particularly for African-American men. And we need to question anybody out there saying that that's a good idea, because if they're saying it's a good idea, either A, they haven't analyzed what it means actually means for vulnerable populations, particularly African-American men and some others, and B, they might have another agenda. And I'm not going to begin to characterize what that agenda is. But I would be very concerned about that agenda.
And again, I'll ask you about the principle, the assumption that many of us had, that as societies become more prosperous, people get to retire earlier and work less.
Society has become more prosperous for those who work on Wall Street, those who work in the financial sector, those who have the top 1% of earnings in this country. But the fact of the matter is that the wealth disparities have gotten huge over the past three decades between those who have, those multimillionaires and billionaires, and all the rest of us, the middle class, the working class. And wages have stagnated for the middle class and the working class, while the wealth of the top 1% of earners in this country has quadrupled in the same time period. So we've got a problem. And that problem is that we are actually seeing a country and a nation where it used to be that we would expect that there would be more opportunities to work your way up the ladder. We're seeing a disturbing stagnation that means that that the opportunities that we have come to expect in the past may not be there certainly for this generation, but definitely not for our next generation unless we rethink certainly our policies and our practices that have allowed this huge and certainly immoral wealth disparity to proliferate.
You've described the cumulative effect of tax cuts and deficit reductions as a form of fiscal racism.
That's right. And I say that because when you look at the cumulative amount that has been spent, particularly over the past 12 years, because you have to realize that when Bush came into office, he actually inherited a surplus from Clinton, although I would argue that the Clinton administration was also complicit in what we've been through over the past 12 years as well, because they actually lowered the bar on Glass-Steagall, which then opened the gates for the financial crisis that we have today. And so what we have here is a situation where all this money has been spent, all this wealth, the wealth that, what little wealth that we had in communities of color and certainly in middle class communities has been some of it erased certainly by the financial crisis for communities of color, certainly more of it because they've also been disproportionately impacted by the foreclosure crisis. And they have not benefited from this spending. You know, disproportionately, communities of color have not benefited from the money that's been spent on wars, the money that's been spent on, you know, tax cuts, the money that's been spent on, you know, even the stimulus. There's a report out that shows that the stimulus has not, the monies have not gone disproportionately to communities of color, and that there's more that remains to be done. And yet, when you look at the generational shift in terms of who's going to have to pay the costs for this spending, and when you understand that it's majority black and brown young people today who will be tomorrow's taxpayers of the future who are actually going to have to absorb that cost, then you have to understand that this is I hate to call it a con game, but I will call it a con game. In the sense that, you know, people who can least bear the burden are going to be forced to cover the costs, and that is fiscal racism.
Our traditional civil rights organizations have focused on issues such as voting rights and racial profiling, and sometimes to the exclusion of the less dramatic and compelling economic dangers that face our community.
Yeah, actually that... It's true that we have tradition, because our organizations have traditionally come out of the civil rights tradition, they're very comfortable when it comes to voting rights or, judicial abuses in the criminal justice system and things like that. And I think I would argue that they've even been credible on issues like certainly the financial, the housing crisis. However, when it comes to the more detailed, all of this stuff that's gone on with regards to the Wall Street debacle and certainly, you know, the social insurance structure of this country and certainly tax policy, we do not, by and large, have the expertise in these organizations to begin to deal with the level of complexity that's required to understand who's getting what, and who's benefiting and who's getting screwed. And what's sad about it is that oftentimes these organizations don't understand, the details and have to be careful that they're not being used to further someone else's agenda who might be seeking to get an endorsement. But with that, I should say that, you know, for example, I found out recently that the NAACP has hired a financial expert who looks at the racial wealth gap. So I think that some organizations are really getting on the bandwagon of trying to catch up.
And that's why we need people like you and your global policy solutions.
Well, I guess you could say that. I'd certainly take it. Come to visit me at www.globalpolicysolutions.com. We actually try to pay attention to the harder issues. You know, we focus on everything from education to income security and certainly health care, and civic engagement. But when it comes to income security, you know, social insurance policy or tax policy, or housing policy, all of these things are things that require certainly sustained study, and you've got to follow the dots because these are complex dots, and all these deals are going every which way. But you have to understand it in order to know how our communities are being impacted. And so with that, we are actually about to launch something called Global Policy TV. Stay tuned. It'll be gptv.com. Where we're going to go on a sustained effort to begin to describe in very simple terms what's happening with our nation's financial affairs and how that's going to impact our most vulnerable communities. So, Glenn, I hope that your site will link to some of our work, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Dr. Maya Rockymore of Global Policy Solutions in Washington.
A federal judge recently ruled that it's unconstitutional for Obama's health care legislation to require Americans to buy private health insurance. We asked Dr. Claudia Fagan, a past president of Physicians for a National Health Program, about the potential impact of the ruling.
What the judge rejected was not the bill in total, but the individual mandate. And we know from the experience in Massachusetts that the individual mandate is not an effective way to cover everyone. And so whether it's ruled constitutional or not constitutional, we don't think it's going to work in terms of providing coverage. I mean, if you can't afford to purchase coverage, you can't afford to purchase coverage. I mean, that's what we saw with the requirements for auto insurance. But the individual mandate in Massachusetts, while it has decreased the number of uninsured, it has not resulted in universal coverage. They probably have half the number of uninsured than they did before they started in Massachusetts, but that's still over 300,000 people who are uninsured. So, I mean, I think that if this is thrown out, then there won't be any way to provide universal coverage other than with a single payer, which is what has been our position all along. You know, mandating people to purchase from the private sector, it's just not an effective way of achieving universal coverage. And the only cost efficiency is if you cover everyone. Well, as long as we continue to have to go through this means testing and seeing who's covered, who's not covered, who's got what coverage, we're going to continue to add to the administrative waste of our system. And we'd really rather put those dollars in providing health care for people as opposed to screening folks out or excluding them.
Of course, the private insurers found the mandate to be totally acceptable to their business plan.
So right, because they get a windfall in terms of the number of people who are suddenly forced to buy their product.
Yes, of course. Now, the Obama administration says that the whole web of legislation unravels without this individual mandate.
Well, it does, because unless you're covering huge volumes of people, you don't get the cost efficiency. And you don't, you know, the reality is that years and years ago when we had community-based rating and we charged the same rate of insurance for everyone, there was efficiency because there was the majority of people don't need care at any given time, and they provide a cross subsidy for those who do. And unless you insure, you know, require everyone to have, unless everyone is covered, you don't get that cross subsidy. I mean, you know, 20% of the population incurs 80% of the healthcare cost. Any one of us at any given time can walk outside, get smacked by a bus, or have some tragedy, and then fall into that 20% that generates 80% of the cost. So you really have to have everyone covered in order to get cost efficiency. But mandating people to buy a private insurance is not going to be the way to get there.
So although the Obama administration says that the mandate is necessary in order for people to share the risk, what you're saying is that the best way to share all the risk is to bring everyone into the game with a single-payer system.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no other way to do it.
Many of us said that the passage of this bill actually set back the ideal, the cause of single-payer by involving the insurance companies directly in the federal money stream. If that is true, and I don't know if you agree with that, but if that is true, then this setback to the legislation actually could be a good thing in terms of the prospects for single payer.
Oh, well, that's true. I mean, it could be quite beneficial for us in the long run. I think that as long as we have the public talking about the need for this coverage and talking about the fact that it's a human tragedy that we, one of the most richest and most powerful countries in the world, don't provide guaranteed access to care, as long as that is on the table, as long as people are talking about that, I think we're making progress towards single payer. I think that the maxim about the American public from Winston Churchill is that you can count on the American public to do the right thing, but only after they've tried everything else. I think in the end we will do the right thing, that we will cover, and the only way we can get there is with single payer. And so I think as long as this remains a topic of discussion, we're making progress. It's true that the Obama administration fell short of our wishes and desires. We think they bent the knee when they didn't have to, that they yielded on issues that they shouldn't have. But we applaud them for continuing to discuss this and recognizing the need that it needs to be addressed by our government. It's something that every American should be entitled to.
So you don't feel uncomfortable being in opposition to this particular bill while forces such as the Tea Party are also in opposition to this bill?
You know, that's an unfortunate reality, but you cannot support something that you know is so badly flawed and ultimately wrong. The insurance industry has profiteered tremendously on the misfortunes of the sick and the disabled. And until we eliminate that problem from our health care system, we will not achieve the efficiencies we need. We're spending enough money on health care in this country. We're just not spending it providing care that our citizens deserve.
That was Dr. Claudia Fagan speaking from Chicago. Civil liberties forces were recently dealt a setback on their bid to stop the Obama administration from targeting American citizens for assassination. John Manis is a lawyer for the American Civil Liberties Union.
The district court has thrown out our case on procedural grounds. They didn't actually reach the merits of our claim, but you know, the point of the lawsuit was just to make sure that there's a check on this power that the president is asserting to put citizens and others on kill lists and then hunt and kill them anywhere in the world, even thousands of miles from any battlefield. So, you know, the point is that the president shouldn't have unchecked authority over the lives and deaths of U.S. citizens. And the point of this lawsuit was just to have a court set out what the rules were for such targeted killings to make sure that they're consistent with the Constitution.
Well, the judge, he cited difficulties presented by what he called a unique and extraordinary case. How is this case unique and extraordinary if the government claims reasons that are not subject to review? In other words, how do we know that the Al-Awlaki situation is unique and extraordinary since the government doesn't tell us about it in any depth at all?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think what's unique and extraordinary about it is that never before has the government publicly announced that it's intending to kill a citizen who's not in a war zone. This isn't a case where a person is, on the battlefield fighting for the enemy. This is a person who is living in Yemen, a place where the United States is not at war. And so it certainly is a unique and extraordinary case where, a father comes into court asking the president not to kill his son. And so in that sense, it's unique and extraordinary. But you're absolutely right that the government hasn't disclosed, even the most basic details about this program and the scope of the program, whether there's other citizens or other people on these lists. So the extent to which it is actually unique and extraordinary is up in the air. There's a lot of secrecy.
I mean, theoretically, I could be on the list. You could be on the list. We're just not activated, theoretically.
I mean, in theory, of course. I mean, I think that basically the program right now is run on the principle of trust us. So the government is essentially saying, trust us, we're only going to kill people who are the bad guys. And we don't think that trust us is enough when it comes to the lives and deaths of American citizens. There has to be checks and balances. That's the way our system works. So the point of this lawsuit was to allow the courts to ensure that the standards that the president was using to put people on these kill lists are consistent with the Constitution. And what we say is that the president can only kill a person outside of a war zone when that person presents an imminent threat to the life of another person. So basically, you can only use lethal force in order to prevent a person from killing another person or from doing grave harm to another person. And that's a very familiar standard. That's the standard that the courts have always applied domestically with respect to the police's use of force. And our lawsuit was simply asking the court to affirm that outside of war zones, that's the standard that governs the president's actions.
But the government is essentially saying we don't have to give a reason for why we put someone on a kill list.
Exactly. I mean, and the court, unfortunately, has more or less endorsed that. Part of their opinion, part of the court's opinion, said that, whether this person or whether any person can be killed by the president is a political question. And what it means to call it a political question is that it's not for the courts. The courts have absolutely no role in that kind of question. It's just for president and maybe Congress to have a role in. And we just think that's wrong. We think that certainly when it comes to killing people outside of armed conflict, there is law, and there has to be law. Otherwise, it really is just a system where the president has unchecked authority, and it's just up to his good faith. And, an important point here is that, some people might be inclined to trust the current administration. Barack Obama is a sensible guy. He has good legal advisors. But this power, once granted to a president, is granted to all presidents. So, we urge people to think about whether they would want potential future presidents or to imagine previous presidents having this kind of power. And we brought this lawsuit because it just isn't enough for the presidency to say trust us.
Well, this rather attractive guy, Obama, is the first president to claim this power, isn't he?
Well, it seems like what President Obama has done is expand a program that existed during the Bush administration. So, the first targeted killing occurred in the first post 9/11 targeted killing occurred in 2002 under President Bush, and that one again occurred in Yemen. But during the Bush administration, it sounds like they had never designated a U.S. citizen to be killed. It was always foreign nationals. So to that extent, this is novel and unprecedented. The idea that you can put U.S. citizens on a kill list and then send the CIA or the military to go hunt them.
I know you're a lawyer, and lawyers don't like to extrapolate beyond the facts or to speculate politically. But do you think that if President Bush had put an American citizen on a hit list, there would have been such quiet on the Hill, quiet in the streets?
Yeah, it's hard to say, politically what the situation would have been. I think that because the majorities in Congress have been on the president's side, there hasn't been as much opposition politically. But the lawsuit that we filed has created, very serious debate over this. Every major newspaper's editorial board has weighed in. People are talking about this issue, and And, you know, people have come down in different ways, but pretty much everybody agrees that at the very least, the president needs to level with the public and tell us what the standards are for getting on one of these kill lists. What criteria does he use to decide that a person needs to be killed without process? So that's encouraging. It sounds like there is a genuine debate about this going on now, and we hope that the administration does the right thing and at the very least discloses the standards, and we hope that those standards are consistent with the Constitution.
What's the next judicial step, and are there prospects for legislative action?
In court right now, we're trying to decide what the next step will be. You know, this decision was from a trial judge, a district court judge. So, you know, we may decide to appeal. We're sort of going through all of our options right now. Legislatively, you know, the decision makes clear that this is an issue that Congress could legislate on. You know, the prospects for that, I'm not sure. I'm not an expert at what's possible in Congress, but you know, this is a sufficiently serious issue that I think that there is a role for Congress to put strict limits on the president's authority to designate citizens for death outside of armed conflict.
When the decision came down, what was the mood among the lawyers involved?
Disappointing, of course. The judge didn't even reach the constitutional issues. You know, the decision said absolutely nothing about whether this was in fact constitutional. What the judge did was threw the case out on procedural grounds. He said first that a father, because we're representing the father of the person that's on the list, and he said that a father doesn't have the right to come into court to defend his son's life, and we obviously disagree with that proposition. And then maybe even more troubling, he said that whether the president has the authority to kill citizens is a question that the courts have no voice in. It's strictly for the president and Congress to decide when citizens can be killed outside of armed conflict. And that's especially troubling because the whole point of the lawsuit is that there have to be checks and balances from the judiciary on this authority.
So the judge didn't really give you much room to maneuver, did he?
No, I mean, the case, if this ruling stands, it's hard to see how the case goes forward. So, that, you know, again, we're considering our options. We haven't taken any decisions yet about what to do next.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio, produced by the same team that brings you blackagendareport.com on the Internet. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my colleague, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Caitlin Fitzgerald.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.